This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. After months of preparation, Melissa Block, Robert Siegel, and a team from All Things Considered were in Chengdu in May to prepare a week-long series of specials from Sichuan Province in southwest China, broadcasts on economics and culture, on politics and real estate, from a part of China that many Americans know only as a style of spicy Chinese cooking. They were there in position when a devastating earthquake changed everything. The most recent estimate of the number killed is 69,000, 5 million more left homeless. For many days, much of the world learned of the disaster through the sounds and words and pictures the ATC team filed for the radio and for our website. Melissa and Robert are here with us at the Newseum. Producer Andrea Hsu joins us from the studios of KTYD in Santa Barbara, California. If you'd like to talk with them about the people they met and what they saw, about how the Chinese government and its army reacted both to the disaster and to scrutiny, and about the economic boom they went to China to cover, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Melissa Block, Robert Siegel, Andrea Hsu, thank you so much for coming in today and giving us the chance to talk to you.
You're welcome.
And tell us,
thank you.
Why did you choose Sichuan Province to do a week-long special? Robert?
Well, Andrea and our executive producer, Chris Turpin, wanted to choose some place in China where we could convey a sense of life in the course of a week of stories, and we felt that people have heard a lot of reporting from Beijing, they've heard a lot of reporting from Shanghai, so we wanted to go, in effect, we wanted to go someplace that you didn't know about. And the idea that the place we went to turned out to be exceptionally newsworthy was utterly counterintuitive, given what our judgment had been.
And Andrea, I guess you were the first one to go there to try to prepare the way?
Right. Actually, Chris Turpin and I went in February on a scouting trip, and we just spent about 2 days there meeting people and actually looking at hotels and, you know, logistical things like that. And then I went back in the middle of March and just started setting up interviews, making contacts on the ground. And Melissa came in April for 2 weeks for a reporting trip.
And one of the things I wanted to get at was the difference between your ability to work in Sichuan Province then, back earlier, before the earthquake happened, and what happened subsequently. Andrea, what was the difference?
Right. When I arrived on March 19th, it was about 5 days after the riots in Tibet, and I had a lot of problems setting up interviews, and these are not interviews that had to do with Tibet. These were interviews about basketball, about sports schools, about dogs. Robert wanted to do a story about the increase of dogs in Chengdu as pets, and the answer I kept getting was, this is too sensitive a time, you're foreign media, you know, we don't really feel comfortable doing these interviews. And then right after the earthquake, it was incredible how much access we had, how many people were willing to talk to us. I mean, Robert wanted to talk to a psychiatrist, and we tried for a couple months to get this interview, and, you know, we're told to send letters of application to various levels of bureaucracy, only to be told, basically, you can't do this interview. And then right after the earthquake, Louisa Lim, our reporter in Shanghai, was able to do a whole story about mental health. So the change was really, really incredible.
Now, Melissa, you must have seen that firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had been stymied on all sorts of things. And with the earthquake, I mean, whether it was that they had a story that they wanted told, which was at that point a fairly positive story for the government in terms of their response, or that they were too busy with other things and access was loosened, whichever, you know, things became much, much easier.
Well, let's see if we can get some callers in on this conversation. It's your opportunity to talk with some of the people who were in Sichuan Province when the earthquake struck. And I guess this is the moment I should say, this is a team effort. We're talking with three of the people whose voices you heard. There were any number of other people on that trip whose voices you did not get a chance to hear, other producers, other technicians, and various levels of, our own bureaucracy were over there, too.
And interpreters
and
were
interpreters
our
as well.
Interpreters who were very important.
And I was going to ask Andrea Hsu about that. And by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Andrea, you went in with the advantage of being able to speak the language.
I speak Mandarin, which is, you know, obviously very helpful, and I could people could basically understand me with no problem. But I had a hard time understanding a lot of people, especially when I first got to Chengdu because everybody speaks Sichuan dialect. And it's not that easy for... I would say it's actually not that hard for native speakers of Chinese to understand, but for somebody like me who learned Chinese as an adult, I had a hard time understanding people there. And so, but it wasn't just a matter of understanding, it was actually communicating with people because people on the ground felt much more comfortable with people who spoke their dialect. So we hired, locally I hired a few people to help us, and actually we had a listener from Massachusetts, Xie Xiaoyu, who came back, he's originally from Chengdu, and he came back specifically to help us early in the summer and late in the spring. And they were just instrumental because they could communicate and also be sort of ambassadors for our team.
Well, let's see, we get a listener in on the conversation. Let's start with Steve. Steve's with us from Wichita in Kansas.
Yes, it is. Hi. I just wanted to thank you for the coverage that you did, and specifically the story, the couple looking for their missing kid and parents, and the way they had to go out and get their own help and their own equipment and whatnot to find their kid. That was truly a driveway moment for me. Not my driveway. I had to pull over in somebody else's driveway because I couldn't get my eye on the road anymore. Thank you very much for that story.
Steve, the story he mentioned is one of the stories. We pulled some tape from some of the stories you did. And this one, in fact, is
Melissa's story,
one of the very tough story about following throughout the day a young couple looking to find not just their son but their parents as well. Let's listen.
三个老人。A worker just came out and said they had found the bodies of a child and two old people. And Mrs. Fu asked, was he a boy of about two? And the worker nodded yes. So they now know that their family has been found and they're all dead. Mrs. Fu just cried out her son's name and she said, Mama is here.
And Melissa, I think that raises a couple of tough points, one of which is, how much do you intrude on other people's grief?
Yeah, it's something that, I think Andrea and I both wrestled with over the course of the day. You were hearing the tail end of a very long 9 hours. We had found Fu Guanyu and Wang Wei as they were in the middle of the city of Dujiangyan. They were clinging to the side of an excavator that was rumbling through the city painfully slowly. And it became clear that they were leading it toward their house. They were in agony. It was, I think, 2 days after the earthquake. And they had finally gotten heavy equipment to come and piece through the rubble. So we spent the day with them. And this is a case where our interpreter, Philip Hay, was invaluable in talking to them and assuring them. There's a lot of suspicion of Western media, but he was, as Andrew said, an ambassador for us in telling them that we were people who could be trusted to tell their story. They certainly had many, many opportunities to tell us to leave. There were local officials there who would have been only too happy to escort us away. And this couple, to their credit and to their immense testament to their bravery, I think, had us stay. And by the end of the day, it became sort of painfully clear over the course of the day that there would be no good news there as they excavated deeper and deeper into this building that was completely destroyed. What Fu Guanyu was saying at the end there, if Andrea will correct me if I'm mistranslating it, but my memory is that she called out to the workers, did you cry out my son's name? Maybe he had just fainted, which was for me just a moment of, it was a story that people obviously have a visceral reaction to. I do as I listen to it now. It taps into goes right into the vein of all the emotions that you might feel. But we did wrestle a lot with how much of this should be on the air. I sent back a 12-minute piece and told our editors, if it's over the top, if it's too much, cut it. I don't want to turn people off. It's either compelling or it's completely wrong, and you guys need to decide because I can't.
Make that decision back in Washington. Mm-hmm. And Robert, there are moments... we can hear catches in your voice. You're a notably unsentimental broadcaster.
Yeah, I was just struck in listening to the sound from Melissa's piece how there are some moments of speech in a language that you don't understand at all, that you barely have to understand. That is, we know what those people are expressing at that moment, and it's to me, it's a horrible moment in their lives, but it just sort of transcends translation. That's the sound of people grieving. That's the sound of people getting the worst news of their lives.
And Andrea, as the producer, obviously you're hoping, I think, that when you go into that situation, of course, that the son will be pulled out alive and the grandparents will be pulled out alive. There must have been a moment, though, when you realized this was not going to happen.
To be honest, when we saw the building, we actually were a little bit confused about which building they were talking about that they, you know, they believed the parents and the child were in. But when I saw that building, I thought, you know, I don't think there's any way that they're alive. Possibly the baby, because the baby was so small. And that's what people kept hoping over the course of the day, that, you know, the baby doesn't need that much space. But as Melissa said, as the day, you know, wore on, we just, I think even the parents really had lost hope by the end.
There's also the question of, this is a disaster on a scale that I don't think any of us have very much experience with. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. by telling these individual stories, you begin to convey some degree of what is going on a mass scale. And Robert, the scale of this, I think even now, is hard for us to comprehend.
Yes. When you drove, to Dujiangyan, this town north of the city of Chengdu, or beyond it, or up through the city of Mianyang, I brought an American perspective, this was my first trip to China, so it was all new to me. I brought an American perspective. I assumed that towns would be a few miles apart, and really little specks on the map would be home to a few hundred people. And instead, it's just the reality of being in China. The villages are a few kilometers, if that, apart, and the places where you'd expect to find a few hundred people in that spot, a couple of thousand people, live there. It happened at 2:30 in the afternoon. That's during the Chinese school day, when every kid in China is back from a long lunch break, back in school. And so if you were inside a school building that was either right on a fault or poorly constructed, that building would collapse and there'd be kids in it.
Okay, stay with us if you would. Robert Siegel, Melissa Block, and Andrea Hsu of All Things Considered, back from China. We're in the Knight Studio in the museum. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the museum in Washington, D.C. NPR's All Things Considered is with us here. That's Melissa Block and Robert Siegel, along with producer Andrea Hsu. And we're talking about their remarkable emotional trip to China that coincided with the disastrous earthquake there. If you'd like to ask them questions about what it was like to cover it, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. 3 days after the earthquake hit, people were still struggling to get basic necessities.
The place is called Gongjing, and Gongjing has run out of water. This morning, a fire truck was parked along the main road, dispensing water from a hose. Residents of the town lined up to fill plastic jugs and basins. When they see our microphones, they start to tell us, we need water, we need rice, we need medicine, we need tents. They say the government came through and searched for survivors in the remains of collapsed buildings, of which there are many. They say this morning the village government distributed some supplies, but not enough, one bottle of water per person. They say they're hungry and they have no food.
And the condition of your homes?
Most of them, 90% or so, collapsed, or the rest of them are in danger, dangerous structures. No one's.
We really need help.
That's from Luo Qi, an 18-year-old student, one of two we met who speaks some English. 21-year-old Jen says many people in Gongjing were injured in the quake or became ill after it.
And Robert, listening to that tape, it sounds like it wasn't that hard to get people to be critical of their government.
They were spontaneously critical of the government, and then the local town party leadership stepped in and was spontaneously critical of the people who were being critical and urged them not to say these things to Western journalists. This was a kind of encounter that I think we experienced it
over and over again.
And yet the people insisted. They wanted to tell us what was going on.
Later on, you run into protests of parents who were saying the schools were constructed with shoddy materials. There was some corruption involved, and the treatment of these parents has been one of these stories after the earthquake, Melissa.
It's evolved in really interesting ways. I had gone the night of the earthquake to a middle school that had collapsed, and you know, from the very beginning, we started hearing criticism of local officials. People there would say, you know, the central government is doing a good job, but it's local officials who are corrupt. They're on the take. We went back a couple of days after the earthquake. A man came up to me with a little piece of concrete from the building and snapped it in two in his hands, and I took it, and it crumbled immediately, saying, you know, they cut corners, they were pocketing part of the, there were kickbacks, and the school was built badly. Somebody told us that it had been designed to be two stories, and then they added two stories on top. I mean, this was repeated over and over, and what you've seen since we've left is a really interesting story of people organizing in protest, in opposition. They've said they're going to sue the government. And then Rob Gifford, our Beijing correspondent who's been in Chengdu, reported last week that parents were dragged away from the steps of the courthouse. They were hauled off. Reporters were detained. I mean, you get the sense that the government was allowing a certain level of protest, but they're only going to go so far, and that you know they are beginning to crack down in very strong ways.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Eric. Eric with us from Orem in Utah.
That's right. Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. And first to the Chinese speakers, I want to say, Da Jia Hao. My question was, I wanted to know what the feel and the response of the people were in the Sichuan province to the government's presence after the earthquake and such. My own personal experience in Beijing was that there's a great feeling of repression a lot of times with the level of control that the government imposes upon its people. And I just wanted to get the thoughts and opinions of the people who were there.
Andrea Hsu, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think it was a couple of days after most of our team left. I was up in a tent city, and people actually seemed pretty grateful because the government had come in and set up tents. I mean, I think this tent city had about 1,500 people. They had set up hot water heaters. They had built a latrine. They actually brought in these big woks so that people could cook. And so I think at least those people, I think, seemed pretty grateful. And another place up in the mountains, there were, I think they were soldiers from Shandong province, and they also seemed grateful because they were coming around and helping them set up tents and things like that. So sort of what Melissa said, I heard a lot of complaints about local government, local officials, but pretty much a lot of support for the central government.
Robert?
Well, first, I think as Andrea will attest, we heard that same analysis of things in totally different contexts, even before the earthquake, which is national policy is good. Local implementation is bad and corrupt. The leaders, the national leaders of China, Hu and Wen, both made a couple of visits to the area, which were depicted on Chinese media in extraordinary, I thought, in what we would find to be incredibly lengthy detail. It was more like a C-SPAN presentation of a presidential visit than a news report. And clearly the government felt that it was doing better by going to Sichuan, showing up, going to the scenes of rescue efforts, because as Andrea knows better than all of us, there's a history, a terrible history, 30 years ago, 32 years ago, of not doing anything in a huge earthquake, and then a more recent history of them getting out during the snow crisis of the winter and publicly apologizing for getting things wrong, and the Chinese leadership seems to be at least attempting to develop what appears to be a normal relationship with the public over these things.
Eric, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And I wanted to play another piece of tape from your reporting, and this was a week after the earthquake when thousands gathered to mourn as a nation.
When the sirens stopped, an entirely different cacophony began. First, wails of grief. Then chants, stand up, be strong.
Minutes of silence have turned into many, many minutes of raucous cheers and chanting.
It's interesting. It's certainly not a celebration. It's not a protest.
But it's a rallying,
it's
a patriotic rally.
A statement of common purpose and obviously great sorrow, and so many of the people you and I are looking at right now, Melissa, are weeping as they're chanting.
And now the chant has turned into go, China, go, China, go.
And there would have been a time, Melissa, I don't think anybody would have had any question that that had been staged. This time, it didn't look that way. It didn't sound that way.
It was a remarkable thing to witness. I can't imagine anything happening like that here. And, you know, you would travel around after the earthquake. We were out maybe 10 days later, and the banner factories had gone into overdrive. Everywhere you went, there were patriotic banners with all sorts of different slogans. Andrea can help me in remembering what some of them were, but all about uniting the people, and we are standing strong, and China is coming together. I mean, it became this catalyst for a real sort of nationalist fervor, and I think the question about the government response really plays into this. I mean, the Chinese people seemed very intent on unifying around this notion that something terrible has happened, but we are strong, and we will pull through.
Andrea, that goes to the whole story of Chinese nationalism that has been so important in that country in the past several years.
That's right. And actually, before the earthquake, there had been, the Chinese people, especially young people, had rallied around this Tibet issue. And I'd been to, you know, a couple of, I think there was a protest against Carrefour, and it was sort of the same, you know, people singing the national anthem and waving the flag. And so it was just a couple of weeks later after the earthquake, I just felt that all of that energy had been put towards, you know, coming together to face this terrible disaster.
Robin?
Well, we did hear, though, that although this was to be a nationwide observance, and this, the 3 minutes of silence, I gather, was, but nothing similar, do I have this right, Andrew? Nothing similar erupted in Beijing or Shanghai. This was a Sichuan thing.
Local
this was
thing.
In Chengdu, yeah.
Let's see if we get a question from the audience here at the museum.
I'm Joshua from Washington, D.C., and does any of you know how many children from the schools that crashed were killed?
You know, I just saw a number on this today, and I'm sure it's really hard to quantify. It's in the thousands. There was some misreporting early on when people said that there were 7,000 schools that were destroyed. I think it was 7,000 classrooms. But the stunning and tragic thing was that sort of in every city that was badly hit, you heard stories about not just one school, but often it was multiple schools. It was the elementary school, the middle school. My memory is that it was something on the order of 8,000 children all in all, although that may be low. It was, you know, obviously many, many thousand too many.
Thank you for the question. Let's see if we get a caller in. This is Arthur. Arthur with us from Kansas City in Missouri.
Good afternoon, all. This is a great topic. First of all, I want to say thank goodness none of you were hurt or injured or, God forbid, killed when you were there. I guess my question is, what was your reaction when you realized you were kind of, it's terrible to put it this way, but in the right place at the right time, all of us had to cover what was going to be one of the biggest stories, you know, certainly of this year?
I think that realization dawned maybe way too slowly. I mean, I think the experience was so surreal for me. I'm not sure about for Robert, but I mean, you heard it in that tape at the beginning of the show that I you know, it was hard to fathom exactly what was going on. When you looked around Chengdu, which is a city of millions of people, probably 5 million in Chengdu itself, and realized that buildings were not collapsed. And you thought, well, it was 7.8. How is that possible? How bad is it out there? And it wasn't until you sort of got out into the other areas around Sichuan and started seeing the extent of the devastation that it started filtering in. I don't know that it really dawned on us all that quickly that we were pretty much the only Western reporters there until we realized that we were also reporting for CNN and NBC and
We may
PBS.
Have been the only non-Chengdu reporters. There. It just isn't a posting that a lot of media from any place other than Sichuan would be. I'm with Melissa on this. I found it pretty slow. And I wanted to know when I got out of the hotel where I'd experienced the quake on an unfortunately high story, where was it? Where was the epicenter? And when they said it, when we learned it was about 90 kilometers away.
50 miles away, right?
50 miles away. I figured if that's what we felt, if what we felt was 50 miles away from the epicenter, if there are a lot of people living up near the epicenter, this is a very big earthquake.
Robert, I was told you slept through the earthquake.
No. No. You have it backwards. You know. I was sitting at my desk in the hotel room when I thought a huge gust of wind hit the room.
Oh, I see.
And ran down 27 flights. That inoculated me against later aftershocks, which I was able to sleep through very easily. There were aftershocks which others found very distressing, but to me it was nothing after that.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Arthur.
Thanks, guys.
Here's an email. Connie in Boise. I listened to every minute of Melissa Bloch's and Robert Siegel's reports from Sichuan. Their reporting was beautiful. It was sensitive without being maudlin. I will never forget the things I heard. Thank you both for letting your hearts show through. And Robert, I wanted to get back to that. Was that something you discussed with the editors? Melissa said she sent that tape back that was so powerful and said, you guys decide back in Washington. I can't judge from here.
No, I don't remember having an actual discussion about that. I wanted to try to keep it, you know, as straight and solid as I possibly could. There were a couple of moments, and just in relating things, I could, you know, I was just terribly saddened in talking about them, and I guess that came through. And I had no great desire to retake it and sound authoritative and unaffected by it. We spent several days talking with people who had just lost the person or people dearest to them. In their lives, and in horrible, instant, you know, unforeseen circumstances. So it was a very sad experience. And well, I did think it was important to report on relief and the volunteerism that began in response to the quake. At its core, this was a story about tens of thousands of people dying. And in a way, I guess as a reporter, I would, on the one hand, like to be there for the discovery of the person who's been buried for 4 days under the rubble. It's a miraculous story whenever it happens. But in a way, it's not the true story of what happens in an earthquake. It's the odd, miraculous exception. And the real story is a terrible volume of grief.
I have to say, Neil, if I can just add one thing, that I think we took our cues to some extent from the Chinese people. I mean, the couple whom you heard from before at their moment of profound grief, within minutes, had composed themselves and were going off to find if there was a crematorium who could take care of the bodies of three of their family members. They had things to do, and they were doing them with unspeakable amounts of calm. I mean, it was boggling to the mind how quickly people composed themselves and got on with the things they had to do.
Melissa Bloch and Robert Siegel from All Things Considered, also with us, Andrea Hsu. They're one of their producers who was with them in China. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Letitia on the line. Letitia with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi.
I wanted to speak to actually the piece of tape you played a little while ago from Gongjing. Robert Siegel was reporting from there about the people who had no water, had no food, had no medicine. And a little later in that same report, he spoke to a pig farmer who was asking for pig feed to be added to the list of things they needed, and he was upset about the number of pigs he had lost. And my first reaction to that was despair and disgust and just, I was completely hopeless with the human race, but in the face of such a crisis, in the face of his countrymen, his neighbors, dying of hunger and thirst, this man was worried about his livelihood when others were worried about their lives, that he was worried about feeding his pigs when perhaps his pigs could have fed these people. And I was very upset. And later on, this made it even more interesting, I actually heard Melissa Bloch and Robert Siegel speaking about their experience reporting from China. Robert Siegel, you seemed to speak with some affection for this pig farmer, and it made me sort of second-guess my own reaction and wonder if there was more to the story that I had missed.
Robert?
Well, first, I mean, I didn't share your reaction, your initial reactions, but I'll come back to that. I went back about 3 days later to the same farm, the same, it's a little collective in a village outside of Gongsheng. And we actually went, we brought some water, and we met the same people and saw them. And Mr. Mao, the same farmer, when we brought him the water, you know, really his first reaction was, I think there must be people more needy than us whom you could give this to. The government did come, and he was actually quite humble. His livelihood and the livelihood of his family and other people from what had been the collective there was in agriculture, and I was stunned to see the farmers going about their work. I guess it's thrashing canola and rice, which they sweep onto the street for cars to ride over. And in his case, he raised pigs, and this was his life, and others depended on him. So I think it wasn't his first concern. It was the addendum that he added, and by that time, about 3 or 4 days after the quake, he was, I don't think he was being selfish. I think he was hoping that he could support his family.
Thanks very much for the call, Letitia.
Thank you, and thank you both for all your reporting there.
Thank you.
We're talking with Andrea Hsu, a producer, and with hosts Melissa Block and Robert Siegel of All Things Considered about their experiences in China before, during, and after the terrible earthquake there. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join the conversation, email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the museum. And here are the headlines from some of the stories we're following at NPR News today. Jim Johnson, the embattled head of the Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama's vice presidential search team, has resigned. In a statement, Obama's campaign team says Johnson has decided to quit to avoid distracting from the process. And President Bush arrived in Italy today, but unlike past visits where he received a hostile reception from tens of thousands of protesters, only about 2,000 protested the president's visit to Rome. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. If you missed our interview yesterday with Lewis Black, you can go over to our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation to see a video and find out what kind of spirituality Lewis Black looks for in a political candidate. You can also download an audio podcast of the entire program and find out how to do that again. That's at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Today we're here with NPR's All Things Considered team, three of them anyway. They had a remarkable experience reporting on the massive earthquake in China. If you'd like to talk with them about the people they met, what they saw, and about how the Chinese government and army reacted both to the disaster and to scrutiny, and about the economic boom they went there to cover, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And again, you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And you were there to report on many aspects of Chinese life, some of them before the earthquake. And here, Robert, you took a look at China's one-child policy.
How many of you are only children? One, two, three. Carrie, only child?
I'm the only child.
Only
in my
child.
Family.
Blair?
Only child.
Only child. Sophie?
Only child.
Only child. Jeremy?
I'm the only child.
Only child.
V, only child?
Only one.
Rainbow, only child. Okay.
I have a younger brother.
You have a younger brother. Yes. And this has to do with the fact that you're from a minority nationality?
Yes.
The rest of you have grown up without having a sibling. A couple of you have a half-sister or a stepsister. Do you think it changes the way you've lived that so many Chinese of your generation are only children? V, you think it has?
Definitely. Wish we had. When we were young, I don't think we had any understanding why this policy there is, but just like, why can't I have a brother or sister?
Jeremy, the same thing?
It's very lonely. The reason that I'm teaching is because I want to compensate the childhood that I didn't have.
Compensate for the childhood I didn't have, not being raised with brothers and sisters.
In China for the past 20 years, if you're not, if you're in the city for sure, and if you're not a member of a minority group, you're limited, with a couple of other exceptions, you're limited otherwise to one child. So a generation, certainly of city kids, in the country it's a little different, but among city kids, an entire cohort has come of age of only children. And which happens in many rich countries. This is a country that isn't quite rich yet. But you have these kids who are accustomed to a system in which you take care of your parents when they're elderly. And Chinese family is now an inverted pyramid of a very small number of young people, and they're outnumbered by their elders. And there's a lot of pressure, both because you're the only kid and you should succeed because all of our hopes are pinned to you, and also because you have to take care of your parents. You have to take care of us when we're old. So it's an interesting generation. Those parents probably knew the terrible chaos of the Cultural Revolution or even worse before it. And they enjoy the current stability, and they're taking part in a huge moment of economic growth. But these kids have a lot of pressure on them.
Mm. And Andrea Hsu, the awful situation, parents with one child who had to then bury that child in the earthquake.
Yes, and that first night when Melissa and I were at that school outside Dujiangyan, that was the thought, I think Melissa first raised it, that a lot of these children would have been only children. And I think it was about a week after the earthquake, there were reports that China was relaxing the one-child policy for those who lost a child in this disaster. In fact, it wasn't. That was the policy. It was, I think, misrepresented in the report. But that has always been the policy, that if a child died, they could have a second child.
A replacement.
Yeah. Well, maybe not a replacement, but a second, another child, right?
The implications of that one-child policy, though, Robert, they're fascinating. It's just not merely how one grows up, but how one is treated by one's parents when one grows up. An entire nation of, I think it's, I've read them described as little emperors.
Yes, there's evidently been a lot of Chinese commentary on this phenomenon, that a lot of kids are doted on by four grandparents, and, you know, the heavy ratio. And they're people who, again, in their youth, they're people who had large families just a generation ago, and now just one kid. So, yes, there's a lot of commenting on perhaps the overindulged only child, but also the highly pressurized only child. Whatever it is, I just found it a very interesting question and wanted to talk to a number of young people about what they made of it. We went to a music school where these little girls, are adorable kids, play the this... Guozheng, I think it is. It's an old, it's like a very zither on steroids, I would say. It's a great instrument. And I asked the head of the school, of your 300 kids, you know, how many are only children? She said, 300. You know, 300. it's a very common experience in Chinese cities now to meet a generation of kids who really have never had those. You know, there are no middle children, you know, there are no... and there are no elder children who've been raising a little one or helping raise a little one. It's a very interesting thing.
Let's get another.
If I can add something.
Go ahead.
Andrea.
Sorry. Robert, I was just going to mention Lele, one of this young woman that Robert interviewed, who's an only child, and her husband is an only child. And actually the rules state that if you are both only children, you can have two. And they were planning on having two. They're having one this fall. And other young people I met said the same thing.
Yeah, we should just explain. The reason for this was
overpopulation.
The population is up to 1.3 billion and change, and they'd been shooting for 1.2 billion, I think, at the 2000. So they didn't quite make it.
100 million here, 100 million there.
Yeah, that's a big country.
Yeah. Let's get a question from the microphone here at the museum.
Hi, Melissa. You mentioned earlier that interview access was broadened during the course of this story. And afterwards, an NPR reporter, I don't know if it was Robert or if it was Rob, followed up with a story about the opening up of the Chinese media. And I was just wondering, what did Chinese reporters that you talked to have to say about this?
You know, I have to say, I didn't talk to Chinese reporters when I was there. I know from talking to our correspondent, Anthony Kuhn, who's been in China for many, many years, that he was really taken by how media coverage had expanded during the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, that there seemed to be a real blossoming, that, you know, reporters were places they hadn't been, they were reporting in a more open way. However, there are certainly stories that Chinese media have not been able to pursue, the shoddy construction of schools being one. I think we're hearing a lot about it in the West. I'm not so sure you'd be hearing about it in China. I did see some coverage in a Chinese magazine, a business magazine has been tracking that, but I think if I were able to read Chinese and were looking at Chinese newspapers right now, I would probably be pretty struck by how different the coverage has been.
Let's get Clayton on the line, and thanks for the question, by the way. Clayton's with us from Fort Dodge in Iowa.
Oh, hi, Neil. Thank you. Neil, I just wanted to revisit the National Day of Mourning. I was in Guangzhou 1 week to the day after the earthquake, and I was struck by the 3 minutes of what I thought was going to be somberness and silence when, as your reporters indicated, an outringing of cars and horns and loud sounds. And I guess my thought on it was that this was, in fact, a real representation of their nationalized feelings. And I just wanted to mention that Guangzhou, as a city, at least in my experience, really did react in a very positive and nationalistic way. And I was, as a participant, there with my head down, really looking around and trying to take it all in, because culturally it was such a different reaction. And I just wanted to pass that information on.
All right. Thanks very much, Clayton. I appreciate that. Here's an email from Wendy. The Chinese are not always the most selfless people in their day-to-day lives. It seems that many of the towns that were affected have now formed a sense of camaraderie to survive in their tents and get the necessities. Did you get a sense that this was a permanent change for them and their attitude toward each other, or a temporary change of heart? Also, what kind of an effect did it seem to have on the rest of China that wasn't physically affected by the earthquake? And, well, why don't we take that in parts? Andrea Hsu, I wondered if you wanted to weigh in on that.
Well, the first thing I was going to say is that we, everywhere we went, we just experienced such generosity on the part of these people who had lost everything, people asking us, had we eaten, did we have water? And I do think that this disaster, it sparked, I think we talked about this on the air, but it sparked this whole wave of volunteerism and people wanting to come out and help. And I think it may have to do with where China is economically, that people have the means to go out and help others. But I don't know, Melissa and Robert, I know you were both, you both also talked about this, saw this.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think a lot of this is still to be written. There's going to be so much, there already is, and there will continue to be so much dislocation. I mean, cities that existed before are not going to exist again where they were. Beichuan, I think, is going to be relocated. This is a city of tens of thousands of people. So I think the notion of, you know, cities helping each other, they're all a jumble now. I mean, people have traveled many, many hundreds of miles. And, you know, also the people who have been left homeless, this is a sitting labor pool now. I mean, you know, you hear about how many millions of migrant workers there are already in China. And I know Rob Gifford has reported on the fact that now these are people without homes, they need money, and employers are coming from the eastern part of China. This is a sitting labor pool, and they can get this labor pretty cheap. So as many migrants as there were before, there are going to be that many more now. Hmm.
Here's an email from Michael in East Lansing, Michigan. Were there any stories that didn't make it to air?
Well, all the stories that I had done in April that suddenly seemed completely tone deaf 1 month later. I had finished 10 stories for this week of broadcast that we had planned. In the end, actually, a number of them did make it. They had to be completely re-reported, but they ended up being, in a way, much more interesting. I had prepared a story about dams and an ancient irrigation system in the city of Dujiangyan. All of a sudden, dams were really interesting because there was a lot of fear that the dams would break and that there would be catastrophic flooding. So
strike when the infrastructure iron is hot.
Yeah, well, exactly. So that story transformed itself in many, many ways. There are other stories, I think about four or five, that still haven't run that maybe there will be a place for. At some point, it will be appropriate for me to be cooking Kung Pao chicken on the air, but probably not.
Not for a while. Robert, that dog story, you're going to get that on the air?
Andrea, who was dogged in trying to get that story. We desperately wanted to talk to the Communist Party, to people joining the party at the local university. It was very difficult, and Andrea was constantly negotiating this. And ultimately, they had no activity. I wanted to record them doing something, or the Young Communist League doing something. And they had no activities at all for us to do. Then they emerged as a coordinator of volunteer efforts, and we found ourselves, you know, recording this scene of tremendous volunteer activity around the Young Communist League. So we got something on the air.
Andrea Hsu, our producer with All Things Considered, hosts Melissa Block and Robert Siegel are with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Thad in Canal, Winchester, Ohio. I was wondering how you personally felt as you realized you were in a major earthquake, then covered its aftermath. On the one hand, it was a huge stroke of luck that you were already at the location where a major worldwide news story was taking place. You got the scoop, so to speak. But on the other hand, you also personally experienced a gigantic tragedy. You interviewed families that had lost everything. You talked with parents whose children had been killed. It had to be heartbreaking. Also, I could imagine it was terrifying to think that you too might be in danger. When it happened, were you glad that you were there? Looking back, have those feelings changed? And have you needed time to decompress after the ordeal? Melissa, you want to start?
That's a lot wrapped into one. I wasn't smart enough to be terrified at the time that the earthquake was happening. I think it was such a surreal experience to feel what was happening that I didn't have the sense to be terrified. And frankly, Chengdu was fine. I feel, in retrospect, very grateful to have been there at this time. It was a remarkable experience. We saw, I think, the best of people at the worst of times. And I am grateful to be working for a news organization that had the resources to put us there and gave us the time on the air and has a listenership that seemed to really respond to the stories and respond to having faces or having voices and names to put with stories. These became very personal stories for a lot of our listeners, and that to me was very gratifying to hear people say, you know, we think of China as the bad guy, the supplier of poisoned food or tainted toys, and now I feel like I understand that country in a whole new way.
Andrea Hsu, I wonder if you wanted to weigh in on this.
I think I was pretty terrified at the time. I remember
Andrea was terrified.
I had the headphones on, and I remember, and I was holding the microphone that I had been using to mic the pastor, and Melissa was holding her own microphone, and I just remember hearing Melissa start talking, and I thought, oh, Melissa's doing a stand-up. But I think I actually was pretty terrified at the time, and I mean, in retrospect, I am glad that we were there, especially because I had been there for 2 months and I had met so many people who later became so helpful, so instrumental to our coverage. And so I was glad to stay there. And I actually, you know, it was hard to leave because I had been there for so long, had met so many people, and I felt very close to the story.
And Robert?
I was terrified at the time of the earthquake. I was in my room on the 27th floor of a hotel, and the hotel should not have been moving that much. And I ran down the stairs, and it took me till about the 10th floor to realize that the building was not about to. I didn't think the building would come down. I was very glad to be there. I, like Melissa, I'd been in New York for 9/11. She worked there then. I just happened to be there by chance. I think being in the news business, when you're someplace where something terrible happens, the way I figure it is, I would be obsessing over this anyway. If my job were to be a teacher or to be a salesman, I would be thinking about nothing but the earthquake or the tragedy at downtown or something. In the news business, you get to do something, be useful at that moment, and to provide some kind of service. And I found that I thought it was, I did need some time to play a little golf when I got back, but I felt that the most therapeutic thing was to be able to do something constructive and appropriate when this terrible tragedy was around us, and felt very good about it.
Mm-hmm. It was also that situation. All of us, and I'm looking at the two people here who I know very well for many years, have called on members of other news organizations to bail us out when we didn't have a reporter there.
Yeah.
What was it like to be in that situation where you were being called by NBC News and by CNN?
I took part in those calls at such ungodly hours, at 4 o'clock in the morning, that I think I was beyond irony, beyond even reflecting on it. And it was sort of unusual to be on the NBC News. It was a little less unusual to be talking to Gwen Ifill, whom I know, and
time,
was on the NewsHour, and I've known Gwen for a long time. But those calls all took place at such strange times that...
Unreal.
We just did what they told us from Washington to do.
The first time and last time that'll happen. And one final question. Who's doing the show tonight?
Michelle.
Thank goodness for Michelle Norris.
Andrea Hsu, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time so much.
Thank you so much.
Andrea Hsu joined us from the studios of member station KTYD in Santa Barbara, California. Melissa Block and Robert Siegel were with us here at the museum. We appreciate your time. And again, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.